I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney signed four bills into law today, including a $4 billion budget.
And the fourth is bill number 160176, which is the sugar sweet beverage.
It'll be another 6 months before that sugary drinks tax takes effect. WHYY's Katie Culinary takes a look at what happens next.
When asked that very question after signing the bill, Mayor Kenney got a little cheeky.
I go back to my office, have lunch.
But preparations are ramping up in Philadelphia's revenue department, which is hiring 15 new staffers to help collect this and other taxes. In this case, the 1.5 cents per ounce tax is levied on beverage distributors that sell to corner stores, supermarkets, and other retailers. Deputy Revenue Commissioner Marissa Waxman says those distributors must register with the city by December.
So there's going to be a fairly small number of taxpayers. Retailers are going to have to simply just buy from a registered distributor. They aren't going to have any tax filing or payment direct needs with the city.
Retailers that don't buy from a registered distributor will have to pay up. And it's up to them how much of the tax they pass on to consumers. It could add as much as 18 cents to the cost of a typical can of soda. The city plans to start collecting the tax in January. But keep in mind, the future of the tax is uncertain. The soda industry is planning to sue the city to stop it, arguing it violates the state constitution. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Next month, the Democratic National Convention will bring thousands of people to Philadelphia and a bit of a facelift to Center City. WHYY's Tanya English explains.
Each night during the three-day convention, starting at dusk, a red, white, and blue display will light up City Hall's South Tower. Former Governor Ed Rendell is chair of the DNC host committee and helped plan the beautification efforts. He says visitors will also see a new mural painted on the median that runs down the middle of South Broad Street. The design includes stripes in hundreds of colors.
It's called 14 Movements, a symphony in color and words. It's done by a Tyler School of Art graduate. And that's another thing. We wanted to involve as many of the citizens of the Delaware Valley in getting ready for the convention.
The Pennsylvania Horticultural Society is planting a garden walk in Rayburn Plaza near City Hall on North Broad. Horticultural Society President Matt Rader says the plan includes crepe myrtles and other plants that will bloom again next year.
It's very much intended as a permanent improvement and a legacy project for the meeting. It's not a beautification just for the moment of the meeting.
The convention runs from July 25th to the 28th, with major events set for the Wells Fargo Center. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Construction is well underway at the Wells Fargo Center, and Broad Street isn't the only part of Philadelphia to see a change as the convention approaches. Efforts include building a demonstration zone for protesters in FDR Park across the street. That zone will include creature comforts, bathrooms, and misting stations. Harder to discern is whether protesters' speech will be safeguarded as well. That's according to Chris Hermes, activist, legal worker, and author of Crashing the Party, Legacies and Lessons from the RNC 2000. He has an article on the issue at newsworks.org and penned the Huffington Post piece entitled, Will Philadelphia Adhere to Decades-Old Restrictions on Police Infiltration at Upcoming DNC Protests? Chris, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Your book, RNC 2000, of course, refers to the convention in Philadelphia. But those laws were actually penned way back in 1987.
Correct. It was at the anniversary of the U.S. Constitution that was held here in Philadelphia. There were protest groups wanting to demonstrate in downtown Philadelphia, and they had been infiltrated, surveilled and infiltrated by Philadelphia police, ironically violating their constitutional rights. So the attorneys locally here took the police to court.
Let's be on the same page with terminology. Surveillance, I presume, is legal. Is infiltration legal?
Well, it was legal until 1987, at which point Mayor Wilson Good issued a directive restricting infiltration by Philadelphia police without the express permission of the city's managing director.
And so in what form did that infiltration then take place in 2000?
The city ostensibly was working with several law enforcement agencies, including the Pennsylvania State Police, which deployed several infiltrators among activist groups, gathered intelligence, which the city then used to raid a warehouse in West Philadelphia where puppets and art and First Amendment material was being produced.
How was that raid legitimized?
Well, they used the pretext that activists were planning violence and were storing explosives in the warehouse. All of it was untrue.
But this infiltration upheld the letter, if not the spirit of the law, because it was apparently not Philadelphia police conducting it.
Yeah, but the question is whether the Philadelphia police did an end run around their policy by using intelligence gathered by the state police. They're all working together under a communications hub, much like today's fusion centers. And it's difficult to deny that they were not able to take advantage of infiltration within the city of Philadelphia to crack down on protesters.
Fusion Centers refers to that collaboration with state, local, and federal agencies?
Exactly. We have one now in South Philadelphia that was erected in 2014, I believe.
What were some of the big takeaways of the book, Crashing the Party?
Well, one of my main themes is that the former police commissioner, John Timoney, was really an architect of today's policing model used against political activists.
That architecture was drawn up post 9/11.
No, it's actually pre-9/11, which is surprising because you'd think that a more aggressive policing model would be implemented as a result of threats of terrorism and that kind of thing. But in fact, these tactics were developed long before 9/11.
And again, the main form of repression we've touched on is this notion of infiltration. Are there other means as well?
Oh, absolutely. It starts with the denial of permits. We've seen one of the largest demonstrations that happened in 2000. The Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign has been denied a protest permit just as it was in 2000. We've seen repeatedly over the past 16 years heavy surveillance and infiltration, violence used against activists, indiscriminate violence, and mass arrests. These tactics are used at political summits, but they're also used across social movements, whether it's Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, or the climate justice movement. These tactics have been used to stifle dissent.
Even before John Timoney.
Yes, before John Timoney. The 60s and early 70s was a time of tumultuous police repression and a very aggressive policing model against protest. However, after that, through the 70s, 80s, and even 1990s, with some exception, it was a much lighter approach by law enforcement. It wasn't until the turn of the century around the RNC 2000 that a new policing model was implemented that is used to this day.
And that's what you're attributing much to John Timoney.
Absolutely.
Hopefully everyone has an interest in the use of free speech and security and safety at this upcoming convention. Chris, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Chris Hermes, activist, legal worker, and author of Crashing the Party, Legacies and Lessons from the RNC 2000. His essay can be read at newsworks.org. Still ahead this evening, as the Trump campaign continues to dominate Republican politics, GOP lawmakers are trying to craft a distinct platform in Congress.
I believe that Speaker Ryan has discussed this with Mr. Trump, and I support Speaker Ryan and his agenda, and I hope that these provisions are placed in our platform.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Over the weekend, a media frenzy swirled around Lee Kaplan, the Bucks County man arrested on charges of sexually assaulting a teenage girl. The girl's parents allegedly gifted their daughter to Kaplan in repayment for previous financial help. WHYY's Laura Benshoff looked into what's happening to the 18-year-old and the 11 other young girls found to be living with Kaplan and why they weren't discovered sooner.
We still don't know a lot about 51-year-old Lee Kaplan or how so many children came to live with him. Bucks County District Attorney David Heckler says the charges so far are based solely on the sexual abuse of the oldest girl.
The gifting of the young woman who was 14 at the time to treat essentially as a wife concubine. Clearly that's child abuse.
He says child advocates who are trained to talk to kids of different ages about crimes they may have experienced are interviewing the other children this week. David Finkelhor is a national expert in crimes against children and poses a question that many asked in the days following Kaplan's arrest.
Why didn't anybody know about it? And oftentimes there are people who do know or have some suspicion, but who didn't feel empowered or didn't care enough to report anything.
He says this situation is unique, and the deck was stacked against authorities stepping in. One factor was the family's ties to the Amish community. Finkelhor says kids in closed-off religious communities may not come into contact with people, teachers or doctors, who are required by law to report suspected child abuse. Kristen Hauser with the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape says community can also be a lifesaver after abuse.
Our resilience comes from within, and it can be amplified or muted by whether or not a person has support around them.
For now, the district attorney says the court has placed all of the kids in supportive housing together. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
Even before Donald Trump got in hot water for his remarks about a federal judge and implicating President Barack Obama in the Orlando attack, House Republicans were planning to unveil their own agenda this summer. WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports on the GOP effort to write their own election year playbook.
Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump recently taunted GOP leaders in Congress, saying they need to get tougher, and that if they didn't, he would just do it by myself. Well, it seems they were already letting him go it alone. This month, House Speaker Paul Ryan has been unveiling a series of new policy proposals called A Better Way.
Let's face it. People know what Republicans are against. Now, we're going to give you a plan that shows you what we are for.
Among other things, the six-part plan calls for requiring those receiving federal benefits to spend more time working or looking for a job. It would also address the nation's borders, but not merely focusing on building a wall. To many in Washington, the series of House Republican proposals draws a stark contrast with what Trump has been promising voters. New Jersey Republican Leonard Lance from Hunterdon County says Trump should get on board with the House proposals.
I believe that Speaker Ryan has discussed this with Mr. Trump, and I support Speaker Ryan and his agenda, and I hope that these provisions are placed in our platform.
For Lance, setting out a clear vision for the GOP is important and harkens back to when Newt Gingrich was swept into the speaker's chair in the early 90s with a simple contract that Republicans campaigned on.
Certainly the contract with America was very helpful in having achieved Republican control of the House for the first time in 40 years, and I hope that the American people will review our policy proposals, and I believe the American people, by and large, agree with our policy proposals.
But Pennsylvania Republican Pat Meehan from Delaware County says he doesn't think the speaker's effort will galvanize Republicans, though he says it will be a useful tool for the party.
I don't know that anybody's going to be running on things, but I think it is clearly a good undertaking to begin to identify issues and solutions that are able to be used as a basis for conversation with the American people.
And South Jersey Republican Tom MacArthur says he's planning to run the same type of campaign he ran 2 years ago, and the issues haven't changed.
It's the same today. It's about security and the economy. And right now, security is in very sharp focus because for obvious reasons. But the two of them are interlinked, and they are what's most essential. We have to have the strongest economy in the world. We have to have the strongest military in the world.
But MacArthur says he's glad the first proposal the speaker unveiled was targeted at the nation's poor.
And I think it's really important to show voters not just what we stand for in the head, but what we stand for in the heart. And here we have an opportunity to try to really improve people's lives by going at poverty in different ways.
but Democrats aren't buying what the GOP is selling. Here's Congressman Bill Pascrell from North Jersey with a preview of the Democratic critique.
The poverty program will put more people into poverty. The financial program will put us deeper into debt and raise taxes, and it would cost about $2 trillion. The general thrust of every one of his reports is to make us a second-rate country.
Pascrell enjoys watching rank-and-file Republicans trying to distance themselves from the party's nominee. But early Trump backer, Congressman Tom Marino of Northern Pennsylvania, says his party disowns Trump at their own peril.
You have these guys around here that are delusional. You have the establishment who wants to make sure that they keep their positions, their power. And I'm as much sick about it as my constituents and the people around the country are.
Much of this will be in flux until the party's official platform gets hammered out at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Savor the final few moments of spring. Summer solstice is just ahead. Let's set our timepieces with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, how can we be so precise about when summer starts?
The Earth arrives at a point in its orbit around the sun at which the axial tilt of the Earth is at its greatest degree toward the sun. We're not at our closest approach at all. We're actually moving as far away from the sun as we get in the course of a year. But it's the top of the Earth's so-called tilt toward the sun that gives us the summer months that we feel. So if we actually do the correct mathematical calculations, here's when we get there. It's today, in just a few minutes. So from this point on, what actually begins to happen is we sort of dwell at this point for a little bit. And then an interesting thing begins to happen. We start to lose minutes of daylight. Unfortunately, I hate to say it, but we start to lose it from the evening. So our sunsets begin to come earlier and earlier. Our sunrises begin to come later and later. But we won't notice that for a while. It'll take weeks before that, and so we can enjoy the summer.
You think the long summer nights, but here we are at the very advent and it's already going to start to diminish?
Yes, but if you actually look back into last month, we've already begun feeling those long evenings from the third week of May, actually, on in through the month of June, the first 3 weeks of June. So we've already been feeling the long evenings of summer. And as the temperature has been increasing and becoming much more seasonal, we've sort of felt like it's been summer for longer than the actual point of the Earth reaching in its orbit reaching this point. So we've been enjoying summer, in a sense, for almost a month.
So let's be patient and wait for it to get dark. What's available to be seen in the night sky tonight and this week?
Well, we have a lot of great stuff. Let's start first with the planets. First of all, tonight is full moon, and that's always a great evening to enjoy in the summer. It's a great time to be out just to enjoy the brightness of the full moon on a nice warm summer evening. This being the first one of summer, we can enjoy this one. But there are great planets to be seen. So we have three planets in the evening sky that look really fabulous under mild magnification. If you have a small telescope, you can easily see over in the south-southwestern sky the largest planet of our solar system, Jupiter. If you come a little bit back toward the east, east-southeast, you'll be able to find two other bright planets, the planet Mars, which is not too far from its closest approach to Earth just a couple of weeks ago. So it still appears large and bright in the evening sky. And a little bit further to the left or to the east is the second largest planet of our solar system, the ringed giant, Saturn. So under 50 power magnification, 100 power magnification, which is typical from a small telescope that you can find these days, you can see the four largest moons of Jupiter. You can see the rings around Saturn, and you can even see features on the surface of Mars. And we have the bright constellations of summer, mostly over in the east. We find the constellations Cygnus the Swan, Aquila the Eagle, and also we can find in the south, near those two planets, Mars and Saturn, we can also find Sagittarius and Scorpius, two constellations that are lower in the southern sky. Better to catch those earlier in the season than later.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up without a space. ways incorporated.